Welcome to the IRIS podcast. You are listening to a talk as part of the Glasgow School of Social Work Research Seminar Series. This talk was recorded on the 1st of March 2011. Tony Evans, researcher at Warwick University.
I suppose the starting point for what I'm going to look at is the tension I think exists between professionals and organisations, because professionals are thought of as workers who have significant freedom in the decisions about how they practice and what they do. But that professionals tend to work in organisations, and organisations set rules and requirements. They specify how decisions should be made. They sort of try to coordinate how people work together so that everybody's sort of singing to the same hymn sheet. And they sort of set up sort of expectations and standards of how people should behave. And certainly, this tension has been identified in sort of ways in which we've thought about sort of social work within organisations, and particularly over the last 30, 40 years, there have been two ways in which we've sort of tended to characterise the organisations which social workers work within. And here I'm primarily talking about sort of my own sort of experience and the areas in which I've done research. So there, it's sort of English of local authorities. And I suppose when in England the social services was set up, it was thought of as a sort of hybrid between the bureaucracy of local authorities and the professional aspirations and characteristics of social workers. And those organisations tried to hold those two together by having a culture which was, while it was governed by a public service ethic, and that's sort of represented in sort of bureaucratic rules and regulations. And De Gea talks a lot about how bureaucracy is an embodiment of this public service ethic of a disinterested attempt at sort of standing aside from bias to provide services in a way which is as fair and consistent across people as possible, but allowing for significant professional choice and freedom in determining who got what and how they sort of used those resources they received alongside the professions they're working in. Then over the past 20 years, a different idea of the organisation has sort of developed, and that's one which is strongly influenced by ideas of new public management and the idea that managers shouldn't just step aside from professionals and allow them to have freedom, but should increasingly direct their work and constrain their choices through more specific and detailed procedures. Although I think even within some managerial organisations, there is an idea of discretion, but it's very much tied up with an entrepreneurial idea of discretion, which is, I think, something which isn't very sort of recognised in the literature. It talks very much about sort of managerialism as controlling professionals. And so over the past 20 years too, in professional literature, there's been this debate about whether, you know, managerialism has led to the end of discretion, or whether there still is room for professional decision-making, choice and opportunities to practice in the way that social workers see fit. And I think the debate is still sort of unresolved. I suppose what I've tried to do in the work that I've done in this area is to argue that really a lot of the rhetoric about managerial control is purely that. We shouldn't sort of equate rhetoric of control with the ability and reality of control. And apart from sort of looking at this theoretically, I suppose I've looked more recently at exploring these issues through a case study of an English local authority. Adult social services teams, where I looked at a mental health team and an older persons team. All the people I talked to, and this includes both local managers and practitioners, we're all qualified social workers. And I wanted to look at the differences in the impact of managerialism and continuing cultures of professionalism across these two teams. to get some sense of the extent of managerial control and any sort of residual elements of discretion. And in this, so what I found was that the local managers and the practitioners shared a sort of a sense of distance, of alienation from central policy making and central policy directions, which they associated with more business culture. And that while there was a proliferation of procedures, this wasn't uniform. It was more evident in the older person's team than in the mental health team. And it was more evident in areas of control of finance and use of finance rather than in areas, say, of practice with people, so practice guidance. So while there was evidently more procedure, but that also the procedure itself, it wasn't as clear as it seemed to be. Again, this is sort of challenging the idea of the rhetoric of control and reality. You'd have, and the thing I particularly looked at were eligibility criteria, so rules of access to services. And they're couched in very general terms about risk and about need, and they actually created discretion themselves, or authorised discretion, because they didn't actually specify these terms. They required people to define them, to operationalise them. And so there was still continuing discretion in both teams, although to different extents and to different and of different natures, that to a great extent in the mental health team it was more overt and acknowledged, and in the older person's team it wasn't necessarily covert, but it was recognised that you had to use it to make systems work, and that also there was room to use your judgment to make decisions fit more your assessment of what needs to be done rather than just simply implementing strict criteria. And in both these teams, the local managers and the practitioners, who, as I said, were also social workers, worked together to make this work and to maintain a continuing sense of professionalism and to acknowledge, well, as professionals, you should use judgment, you shouldn't just follow rules blindly. And so this, for me, moving on, raised questions about if the literature and the evidence points to existing discretion, okay, it's different in different areas, what role do practitioners themselves play in constructing this discretion? What attitudes do they have to not just how they can use discretion and what they can get at the end, what values should inform it, but how they understood their role as professionals with discretion. Should they have freedom? Should they not have freedom? What extent should that freedom be? Where should they be allowed to exercise judgment? Where shouldn't they? And that was tied up very much in my mind to the idea of their relationship to rules. Now, are rules things that we follow? Are they guidelines? Or are they things that, well, they may be there but don't apply to us? And as a starting point, I sort of took an idea from Oakeshott, and he distinguishes, he's a very broad brush ideas, but nomocratic and telocratic approaches to rules. So the nomocratic is looking at them sort of literally, in a sense. Rules are rules by their nature. They need to be respected and followed as far as possible because although he says that rules are respected for their own sake, I think behind his ideas are also a sense that rules are there because they provide security and stability to a system. And for him, when people approach rules in this way, discretion is a very limited idea. It's just about interpreting the rules, but trying to stay as close to the rules as you can. And so the interpretation is about precision and clarification. An alternative approach is what he describes as telocratic, so it's aiming towards something. And for him, then, rules are approached in terms of things they achieve. And people may have different goals in their practice, and so they will approach rules and judge them according to those goals and decide whether or not they agree with them, whether or not they want to follow them. And that this approach sort of assumes and, in a sense, supports wide-ranging discretion, because it's saying the most important thing is the substantial aim you want to achieve, not necessarily following rules. And while he distinguishes these two perspectives, I think that the interesting thing about his approach is that he says, well, actually, you're going to see these in most situations in some sort of mixed-up way. And what you need to do is not sort of simply approach it as if there's one side or the other, but look at concrete examples, look at how these things are developing, to see how there's the balance, how these are mixed in practice. And he's talking about both the ways in which states operate and actors within states operate. And my interest is in social work within the state. So I think it's a useful starting point in terms of trying to think about, you know, how people operate and to start to explore those things. And so what I did was, with the study I'd done before, I went back, obviously got ethics permission, sorted that out within the university. And so I was looking again at the two social work teams, and there were four practitioners in each team and two managers in each team. So it's a total of 12, so it's a very small study. And what I wanted to look at was their attitudes to eligibility criteria and how they felt about them. Did they feel that these criteria need to be applied equally? So it's a way of getting at, well, do you think rules are clear and you just have to apply them across the board? And do you think that it's ever permissible to bend rules, to ignore them or to break them? So through that, trying to get at whether or not, well, people's attitudes to rules, whether they felt rules had authority in themselves and you shouldn't, or whether, you know, rules were just a means to an end and you could use them as you wanted to or ignore them if you wanted to. And so what I want to do first of all is I'll go through the findings and just explain that the way in which I've done this is the numbers were very small, and it's predominantly women in both managerial and practitioner groups. There wasn't really the space there to explore things like gender and certainly not ethnicity, and to explore what their impact may have on findings. But I will go back to those questions a little later, just in terms of reflecting on some of the findings. So the two broad groups I wanted to look at was to contrast managers and practitioners, because some of the literature suggests that managers will have a different approach to discretion than practitioners. Practitioners will be more interested in discretion. Managers will be more interested in enforcing rules, would be a sort of simple way of putting it. And within the practitioner group, what I did was look at broadly what patterns were there. And I found two broad patterns. And again, I'll come back to this because I think one of the points I want to make is, well, there is always the risk of, well, if you're looking for two groups, you'll find two groups. But the first group, I found valued rules, and they did accept that there was some role for discretion. But it was about bending rules, not about breaking rules. And the second group was much more gung-ho about discretion, and their basics of approach was, well, rules, okay, but I'll make a judgment myself about whether I should act within them, and then, you know, I have to think about the consequences, but it's my judgment that counts over what the rules say I should do. So for this first group, I'll sort of go through and I think through the description get a sense of both how they saw rules and the rationale they had for the position that they adopted. So these were the rule benders. For them, the starting point was the importance of rules, the value of rules. And that's because they had both ethical importance outside them being necessarily organisational rules, but also some utility in terms of working in a setting where you have to work with other people. And the flexibility was about working within the spirit of the rules, but sort of tweaking and changing and adapting and trying to make things work without moving away from that spirit, and if possible, moving away from the letter if they could too. They tried to avoid that. And one of the reasons for their commitment to rules was that it wasn't a blind obedience. It was that rules are there for good reasons. They're about promoting equality, equal treatment. And that's part of being professional. And it's also part of avoiding preferential treatment and favouritism. And again, this echoes some of the work that Duguay has done about bureaucracy, that rules are there because it's about rights and about people's relationship to the state as citizens and being treated equally by state actors. But they weren't seen as so prospective as to be inflexible. And this is where I think the idea of professionalism starts to kick in a bit. As saying, well, yeah, rules are important, but... And they felt that there was some sense within the rules which would allow them to be flexible, but to maintain the rule at the same time. So this person talks about being able to... You know, overall, the same amount of service would be provided to the person, but there was flexibility. You didn't have to apply that at a routine, regular rate. You could sort of wait at the front or the back of the service so that you could reflect their changing needs or their particular preferences for when services go in. And that why you may follow rules, it doesn't make you uncritical. You know, there was also a professional responsibility within the system for, okay, you do it, but then you will go back and say if it's stupid. You'll challenge why that rule is there and seek to change it. And part of this was also the importance of a work environment which was ordered and based on trust. And there was concern amongst this group about, you know, being a maverick social worker. Because if you're a maverick, then who can trust you? Who can work with you? This is very much about of colleagues and within the organisation. Because you know, you've got to work together. Without that sense of trust, without that structure, things will be chaotic. And this also related to their idea of their relationship with the management hierarchy. There was concern that sometimes... rules were broken by managers, by senior managers, especially, say, if there was somebody who was going to be making a complaint. And that was felt to be unfair. Why should somebody who was articulate or pointy-elbowed be able to push aside a rule because they made threats? And that sort of undermined for them the sense of trust, not only with colleagues, but within the organisation. If the organisation expected them to follow the rules, then... So managers should be bound and guided by the rules as well. And part of that too was also a sense in which, well, when we're talking about rules too, it's about rules structuring practice, an important role there, but not about guiding the minutiae of practice, not constituting practice. So there's also an implicit criticism there, or potential critique of the way things may develop under sort of more managerialised setting. And this comes out a little further, where there are some sort of concerns about how things are changing and that rules moving from providing a structure to actually constituting practice. Is raising a question for some of these practitioners about whether they actually still want to be social workers in the setting. For the second group, rules were means to an end, and that for them, being able to operate within their judgment was really the defining characteristic of their professional practice. And that So what limited it was a recognition of, well, in organisations, rules are backed by power. And so they'd learned through experience that they had to develop a political sense of what they can do and what they couldn't do. But that essentially their commitment was to an ethical idea of practice which they defined and which they specified. And this was because rules, and part of their concern about rules was that organisation rules cannot capture the day-to-day experience of practice or the concerns, the day-to-day concerns of practitioners. And that they would see, and eligibility criteria were really very bad guides to the ways in which you could help people and meet people's needs. You had to work despite them to act in accordance with values. And this was because the way in which criteria also specified needs was for them an impoverished idea of practice. I think behind this too, and again I'll come to this later, I think is a sense of the changing relationship between these practitioners and the organisation within which they worked. That there was a sense from one or two of the people that social services had been an ethical organisation, but with the development of more business orientation and a commitment to managerial practice within the senior ranks, the organisation was almost moving away from them. And I think this is captured here too, in the sense of there is a sort of reluctance to name and acknowledge that they're sort of not acting within the rules and trying to define it as, well, I am really just sort of pushing things, aren't I? And again, these sometimes are subtle distinctions of degree rather than sort of firm category. And the idea behind this was a sense in which, well, I was employed as a professional. A professional is there to make decisions, and that's my role, that's part of what policy, that's part of the organisation in the sense that policy isn't just rules, it's about the people you employ to make the organisation work. And I was employed as somebody who didn't necessarily have to follow the rules in the same way, say, as a bureaucrat would. So those were the two broad perspectives I found in the practitioner group. With managers, and again, these are local managers, and I was interested in local managers because one of the characteristics of professional organisations is that local managers tend to be people who are of the same professional background. So we're talking about social workers who are managed by social workers. Unlike sort of senior managers, I think historically senior managers used to be of a social work background, certainly in a lot of English authorities over the past 20 years, people from non-social work backgrounds have been seen as the appropriate people to be managers and to use things like, say, business degrees and business training to sort of change professionals, people with professional backgrounds too, into more business-orientated and minded managers. So looking at the local managers, all of them sort of were talking about, yes, you need rules, but they're never going to be clear cut, so you need to have some judgment, need to have some flexibility. But again, this nature of flexibility, this role of judgment, was seen in two different ways by two managers. There's the four managers split into two groups of two. And for one, the starting point was rules were important and They give clarity, they give structure to the organisation, and what people can do is bend. They stay within the spirit, but they may not keep within the law. Whereas for the other group, the sense was, well, the rule itself may be daft, so we don't really need to sort of give it too much credence. It is what we can get away with. You know, it's valuable, it's professionally acceptable to break rules. But again, there has to be this sort of sense of a pragmatic recognition of the power of the organisation and the sanctions that are available. So for those bending rules group, as I said, it's about making the system work. And you can think about things like, say, working to rule. How if an organisation works to rules, follows the rules literally and consistently, then it can soon sort of come to a halt. So there's this recognition that you have to have that sort of sense of freedom. But that you also had to have this sense of reality that, and with eligibility criteria particularly, whatever you think of the rule, you can't do anything about it. You have to engage with the material reality of the organisation. And, there's a question there about whether that's saying, I would break it if I could, but I can't. But there's also a sense in which it's valuable. I do value rules. And this was, again, the argument against chaos. Is you have to have some sort of structure to ensure fairness and to ensure sort of a non-chaotic work environment. The rhetoric from those who were more committed to the role of judgment as, do you need the rule or not, emphasised the sense in which they started off from position. Their default position was, I don't really care about rules, so blow them if they don't work for me there. But that I've learned from experience, I'm not stupid, about both those rules which are seen as important within the organisation and those where I'll get punished if I break the rules. So I have to be careful, I have to have this political sense about how I go about actually doing what I would do if I could. And one of the things also that came out was that when I looked at both the local managers and the practitioners, I think I'd assume that, the rule-bending practitioners would be managed by rule-bending managers. And similarly, rule-breaking by rule-breaking managers. But that wasn't the case. You'd have practitioners who valued rules managed by a manager who was very much, sort of blow the rules. But that manager also managed some people who subscribed to her perspective as well. Right, so what? It's a small study. What can we learn from it? It's explorative. It's not a claim that this is how the world operates. And it arose from the questions I described earlier on. Because I suppose what I wanted to do was to try and move in my own mind from just this concern with, is there discretion or isn't there discretion? To consider how discretion is used and how people see discretion. And the seeing discretion bit was also part of saying, yes, people's environments are determined by those outside, but practitioners are also implicated and collude with or can challenge in question the structure of discretion within which they work. So I was looking at the nature of discretion from the practitioner's point of view. How did they contribute to the ideas of discretion they were operating in, not just how they were sort of imposed on them. And the ideas that they had about its value. And the value sometimes that we can place on professionalism. Is it good to be a boring professional, a consistent professional, a solid professional? Or is it best to be sort of like a maverick cop professional? And this was also about how they understood this sort of area between the structure of practice and the chaos of day-to-day working and the lives that they were working with, the pressures, the differences, the new issues which arose. How did they manage to negotiate these things and see their role in doing that? And another so what point is, well, isn't there the danger that if you go in looking for two perspectives, as I said, you're going to find two perspectives? I suppose my answer to that is, well, yes, in a sense, but I would assume that anything you look at, you're going to go with a viewpoint, so you need to be clear what that viewpoint is. And part of considering the material that comes up through any study is being careful about the stuff you put to the side, the stuff that which doesn't necessarily fit the tidy picture. And through sort of engaging with this, it was clear that, and I think it's evident too, that the perspectives are not sort of unquestioningly held and not tidily held. There is some sort of shift and overlap, and that we need to be aware of those of tensions. Part of the material, in terms of shift and overlap, which I'll talk about now, raises the question about, well, is it that through people who are saying, well, I sort of value rules, but I have to have discretion on the margins, I have to have some flexibility, is that really that they're coming to the same place as people who are saying, well, you know, I don't really value rules, but, well, perhaps it's useful, and, well, even if it isn't useful, well, I have to follow them. So, practically, they're both saying, well, there's a balance between discretion and rules. And I think there is, but I think they're coming at that balance in a different way. And there, it's useful to recognise this, because it does give a different sense of where they see discretion and what they understand when they're talking about discretion. So for the people who value rules but accept there is some need to bend them, for them, rules are important, rules have authority, and discretion is about making the rules work. It's about doing pragmatic things to make the rules work rather than challenging the rules or through your practice going against them. Whereas for the other group, discretion is very much tied up with a commitment to practice, whereas rules were tied up to commitment to practice for the first group. And rule breaking is part and parcel of a sense of you're there to achieve things, and the material you work with, rules, colleagues, are means to an end. That it's your idea of what you should be doing, what you should be achieving, which is primary. But that this is constrained by the realities of power over you and around you within the practice setting. So there are discretions rather than discretion. And through this we get the sense of a different sense of rules. That for rule breakers, their rules do have some value in themselves because they embody this issue, this value principle of impartiality, about equality as, I suppose, same treatment by official bodies, with flexibility on the edge. Whereas for the rule breakers, rules don't have any inherent quality. The inherent value is in their judgment. And it reflects different senses of accountabilities too, that discretion for the rule benders is about giving account for their flexibility in terms of the rules in the organisation. Whereas, again, for the rule breakers, accountability for discretion is in terms of their own values and commitments. But that has to be tempered in relation to the organisational context. Part of, I suppose, what I was interested in was about how these attitudes also relate to roles. And one person I've looked at quite closely in relation to expectations about this is Lipsky and his theory of street-level bureaucracy. And in that, he sort of characterises practitioners almost by their nature as people who seek discretion, seek to go around or shift around rules, whereas managers are by their nature committed to rules. And this is related to what he describes as the corrupted world of work, that to survive in that setting, practitioners have to use their discretion to find ways in which they can operate and stay in one piece. He recognises that people respond to this corrupted world of work in different ways, that sometimes they use their discretion to be paradoxically inflexible at rules, but often they use their discretion to circumvent and move around rules. But he sees the account that it's largely in terms of, you know, the environment they're working in. It's a psychological response of survival, it's a strategy that they use. But he doesn't seem to be interested or want to take account of, well, why do people approach things in different ways? Why do they use different strategies? Are they just psychological strategies? Are there principles involved here? And I think what I want to sort of argue that this study sort of suggests is it's a useful question to ask is, well, how do people's values and perspectives influence how they respond in this environment to the idea of discretion? Relying on an account which says environmental factors contribute to discretion is useful, but it's not enough. We need to have some idea of how practitioners themselves respond to that environment in terms of their own understanding of their role, and particularly when we think of professionals, their understanding of their professional role. And looking at these accounts of discretion too, as I was saying, within the same team, you could have practitioners with different stances managed by managers who didn't share the same stance with all practitioners. And this again sort of points to the need to take into account some sense of how the practitioners themselves viewed their role and what they sought to achieve through their role. So acknowledging that to analyse discretion, we also need to engage with ideas of how professionals see who they are and what their role is and what they seek to achieve through their role. And there are various dimensions that this could be explored through, and as I said, because of the nature of the study, gender may be one approach, but the nature of the study meant that it wasn't really sort of a practical one to explore these ideas through. It may be about political commitments. You know, for instance, do people who follow rules see this? Are rules just a way of expressing commitment for what the organisation is about? So one person I looked at, there was this sense of bereavement almost for the previous way in which social services operated, and a fear about the way in which social services is developing more business orientation and a more sort of controlling orientation, where for them rules, their sense of being able to work within the setting, they were very much committed to the idea that they should operate fairly, they should follow the rules. But they felt that, well, because the nature of the rules, the content of the rules within the organisation, you know, and rules I'm talking primarily about eligibility criteria and rationing, were becoming tighter and less facilitating of services, that they felt they couldn't stay within social services, and this person actually subsequently left. And the different perspectives within the practitioner management groups, you know, how can we explore those? Are they about Then there may be our individual commitments. They may reflect different schools of social work. You could, you know, certainly rule followers, you can link to approaches within social work which emphasise. I'm thinking of some, there's an article in the BJSW in the early 90s in which Geraldine McDonald talked about, you know, the value of managerialism, because what it did was it sorted out all this sort of political stuff and just ensured that practitioners could concentrate on doing proper technical social work. And you have sort of another approach, which is more akin to radical social work, which sort of challenges the idea that, you know, the ideological control of practice should be located in the organisation and critiques managerialism for that reason. It may be that different perspectives reflected different expectations when people trained. They may have come from different schools of social work, for instance. They may well have trained at different times when different ideas about social work and the relationship between social work and the organisation pertained. Again, these aren't conclusions, these are questions. I think this is part of an agenda for further work. And that there are, you know, shifts and moves within, potentially, shifts and moves and dynamics here, where people may move between perspectives. And what's that about? The quote earlier where the person was actually talking about breaking rules, but was trying to convince themselves or tell me that actually it's not breaking a rule. What I'm doing is sort of I'm bending it. Was that about their presentation to somebody else, or was it about how they were struggling themselves with a sense of running together their idea of professional commitments and professional discretion with a sense in which they may owe something to the authority of the organisation? And that this person I talked about just now, who was talking about the way in which the rules within the organisation were changing. They were changing in a way which, as she felt, she was losing the sort of organisation she could work within because she accepted those rules. And her response was to leave. But say if she'd stayed, would that mean that she would then sort of shift from being someone who thought, well, I can operate professionally within the setting by just bending the rules, to someone who felt I've got to take a much more proactive breaking rule approach? The end.
This recording is copyright of Iris 2011. It may be reused under the terms of the Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Sharealike 2.5 UK Scotland license. Go to www.iris.org.uk for more information.